Hello, and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the May 31st to June 6th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, a photo montage of a city skyline. It's unusual in that the high-rise buildings aren't just standing tall. They're poking into the picture from all directions. The headline, New, Untested, and Dangerous, a special report on American finance. The cover leader article, New and Untested, American finance, always unique, is now uniquely dangerous. Donald Trump is putting an untested system under almighty strain. After that, we'll hear four additional leader articles before returning to that special report. The other leaders start with How to Repel Talent. Pausing foreign applications to American universities is a terrible idea. The Trump administration hobbles a great American export. Then, a dictator's progress. First, he busted gangs. Now, Nayib Bukele busts critics. El Salvador's president has all the tools of repression he needs to stay in power indefinitely. Then, intensive care. How labor should save the NHS. Among all its ideas, the most important is to go all in for digital transformation. And then finally, the lesser of two evils. India needs to turn the aircon on. If its awful air pollution is ever solved, the country will get even hotter. Then after that, we'll go back to the special report on American finance for three, possibly, articles, starting with The New Masters of the Universe. Financial giants are transforming Wall Street. Thomas Bennett hails their innovation and dynamism, but warns against hubris. Then future shock, how the next financial crisis might happen. The new titans of Wall Street present the world with new risks. And then, time permitting, trapped capital. What it means to be illiquid. Investors are learning how hard it is to get money out of private equity and venture capital. So, back to the start we go for the cover leader. New and untested. American finance, always unique, is now uniquely dangerous. Donald Trump was putting an untested system under almighty strain. Always a haven in dangerous times, America has itself become a source of instability. The list of anxieties is long. Government debt is rising at an alarming pace. Trade policy is beset by legal conflicts and uncertainties. Donald Trump is attacking the country's institutions. Foreign investors are skittish and the dollar has tumbled. Yet, astonishingly, one big danger lurks unnoticed still. When you think of financial risk, you may picture investment banking capers on Wall Street or subprime mortgages in Miami. But as our special report explains, over the past decade, American finance has been transformed. A mix of asset managers, hedge funds, private equity firms, and trading firms, including Apollo, BlackRock, Blackstone, Citadel, Jane Street, KKR, and Millennium, have emerged from the shadows to elbow aside the incumbents. They are fundamentally different from the banks, insurers, and old-style funds they have replaced. They are also big, complex, and untested. The financial revolution is now encountering the MAGA revolution. Mr. Trump is hastening the next financial crisis by playing havoc with trade, upending America's global commitments, and, most of all, by prolonging the government's borrowing binge. America's financial system has long been dominant, but the world has never been as exposed to it. Everyone should worry about its fragility. The new firms are a magnet for financial talent. They also enjoy regulatory advantages because governments forced banks to hold more capital and rein in their traders after the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. That combination has led to a spate of innovation, supercharging the firm's growth and propelling them into every corner of finance. Three big private markets firms, Apollo, Blackstone, and KKR, have amassed $2.6 trillion in assets, almost five times as much as a decade ago. In that time, the assets of large banks grew by just 50% to $14 trillion. In the search for stable funding, the upstarts have turned to insurance. Apollo, which made its name in private equity and merged with its insurance arm in 2022, now issues more annuities than any other American insurer. The firms lend to households and blue-chip companies such as Intel. Apollo alone lent $200 billion last year. Loans held by large banks increased by just $120 billion. New-look trading firms dominate stock picking and market making. In 2024, Jane Street earned as much trading revenue as Morgan Stanley. There is much to like about this new financial system. It has been highly profitable. In some ways, it is also safer. Banks are vulnerable to runs because depositors fear being the last in the queue to withdraw their money. All things being equal, finance is more stable when loans are financed by money that is locked up for longer periods. Most importantly, the dynamism of American finance has channeled capital towards productive uses and world-beating ideas, fueling its economic and technological outperformance. The artificial intelligence boom is propelled by venture capital and a new market for data center-backed securities. Bank-based financial systems in Europe and Asia cannot match America's ability to mobilize capital. That has not only set back those regions' industries, it has also drawn money into America. Over the past decade, the stock of American securities owned by foreigners doubled to $30 trillion. Unfortunately, the new finance also contains risks, and they are poorly understood. Indeed, because they are novel and untested by a crisis, they have never been quantified. One lot of worries come from within the system. The new giants are still bank-like in surprising ways. Although it is costly to redeem a life insurance policy early, a run is still possible should policyholders and other lenders fear that the alternative is to get back nothing. And although the banks are safer, depositors are still exposed to new firms' risk-taking. Bank loans to non-bank financial outfits have doubled since 2020 to $1.3 trillion. Likewise, the leverage supplied to hedge funds by banks has ballooned from $1.4 trillion in 2020 to $2.4 trillion today. The new system is also dauntingly opaque. Whereas listed assets are priced almost in real time, private assets are highly illiquid. Mispriced risks can be masked until assets are suddenly revalued, forcing end investors to scramble to cover their losses. Novel financial techniques have repeatedly blown up in the past because financial innovators are drawn to test their inventions to breaking point, and the first time around, that threshold is unknown. Under Mr. Trump, the next upheaval is never far away. The government's excessive borrowing imperils bond markets, alarming foreign investors. Although a court has this week limited the president's powers to wage trade wars, the administration is appealing and Mr. Trump is unlikely to abandon tariffs altogether. A toxic combination of uncertainty, institutional conflict, volatile asset prices, higher capital costs, and economic weakness threatens to put the new-look financial system under almighty strain. A crisis would test even the most capable policymaker. Much about the risks of the new superstar firms and their linkages to the wider financial system and the real economy will become clear only when trouble strikes. New emergency lending schemes would be needed. Rescuing banks last time was politically toxic. Saving billionaire investors would be an altogether harder risk. And yet, if the biggest of these giant firms were left to fail, it could lead to a global credit crunch. Under Mr. Trump, a rescue would be unpredictable. In 2008, the Treasury and Federal Reserve acted quickly to save the banks and set up swap lines to offer dollar financing to much of the world. Mr. Trump might decide to bail out everyone, But imagine the panic if he started to pick his favorite financiers, threatened to abandon or charge countries that displeased him, and changed his mind every 5 minutes on Truth Social. There will be another financial crisis. There always is. Nobody knows when disaster will strike. But when it does, investors will suddenly wake up to the fact that they are dealing with a financial system they do not recognize. That was the cover leader, new and untested. American finance, always unique, is now uniquely dangerous. Donald Trump is putting an untested system under almighty strain. And we'll move on now to our second leader article, How to Repel Talent. Pausing foreign applications to American universities is a terrible idea. The Trump administration hobbles a great American export. The Trump administration's decision to pause all visa interviews for foreign students who want to study in America, pending a review of how applicants' social media posts are vetted, is yet another escalation in the power struggle over who controls the world's best universities. The policy may be modified. It may prove less onerous than it looks at first glance. Even if that happens, though, this is another blow to a great American success story. President Donald Trump cares about America's trade deficit, so it is perverse for him to make it harder for one of America's most prodigious exporters, the education industry, to sell its services to foreigners. Some of his supporters imagine that foreign students are taking places that could have gone to Americans. This could be called the lump of college fallacy. In fact, by paying higher fees, foreign students tend to subsidize locals. American universities attract a wider variety of the best minds from around the world than any of their global rivals. That makes them more dynamic and innovative. And by pulling foreign elites into America's cultural orbit, they magnify America's soft power abroad. Unfortunately, that is not how Mr. Trump and his cabinet see it. To them, elite universities, in particular, are hotbeds of anti-Semitism and wokery. They are factories for future Democratic Party leaders and donors. And they must be brought to heel. The universities are the enemy, as J.D. Vance, Ohio State and Yale Law, told a conference of national conservatives before he became vice president. There is some truth to MAGA criticisms of elite universities. Some have indeed been too soft on anti-Semitism and too dismissive of conservative viewpoints. But that hardly justifies the cudgels the administration is wielding against the entire college system. So far, they include deporting foreign students for wrongthink, freezing applications from foreign students, suspending government research grants, and promising to increase taxes on big college endowments. Mr. Vance has often complained, with some justification, about censorship on campus. So it is galling for him now to favor deporting foreign students for their views and making new student applications subject to social media vetting. College is supposed to be a place where the young explore new ideas, not a place where they venture only with burner phones, terrified to reveal they once shared a meme sympathizing with Palestinians or mocking Mr. Trump. The only students likely to have clean social media feeds will be those from police states like China, who have internalized the lesson that free expression attracts unwelcome attention. Perhaps that is why the administration has also said that it will, quote, aggressively revoke visas of Chinese students. In the global war for talent, America's universities have long been its most persuasive recruiters, with huge benefits for American science, business, and arts. Mr. Trump's policies will make them less attractive. Foreigners have other options. Why pay to study in a country where the president doesn't want you, your visa could be revoked before you graduate, you will be snooped on, and you may not be allowed to work? American universities are so good that large numbers of foreigners will still jostle to attend them. However, the early signs are that all this really is deterring applicants. Mr. Trump and his supporters may think that by cutting snooty lefty institutions down to size and shutting out foreigners with distasteful views, they are making higher education in America great again. They are on course to make it mediocre. That was our second leader article, How to Repel Talent. Pausing foreign applications to American universities is a terrible idea. The Trump administration hobbles a great American export. And we'll move on now to leader article number 3, A Dictator's Progress. First, he busted gangs. Now, Nayib Bukele busts critics. El Salvador's president has all the tools of repression he needs to stay in power indefinitely. Nayib Bukele's autocratic tendencies were already clear when he ran for a second term as El Salvador's president in 2024. He had extended a, quote, temporary state of emergency for 2 years and used it to lock up legions of alleged gangsters without due process. He had ignored court rulings and used soldiers to bully lawmakers into supporting him. After his party won a supermajority in the legislature in 2021, he used it to stack the justice system with cronies. El Salvador's constitution limits presidents to 1 5-year term, but those friendly judges waved him through. There was evidence that his government had done deals with the gangs and bought their support in elections. Salvadorans did not care. They re-elected Mr. Bukele in a landslide with 85% of the vote. They loved him because he made the streets safe. Gangs had terrorized the country for decades. The murder rate in 2015, at 106 per 100,000 people, was the highest in the world. Every corner shop and bus company faced the threat of extortion. Mr. Bukele ended this by jailing 85,000 people, equivalent to 8% of all young men in El Salvador. Anyone suspected of gang ties, because of a tattoo, a tip-off, or a policeman's hunch, could be locked up indefinitely without trial. By 2024, the official murder rate was only 1.9 per 100,000, lower than in the United States. Extortion all but disappeared, since gangsters were too scared to show their faces. Voters were so grateful that they overlooked the power grabs that came with all of this. Only a few liberal voices warned that the strongman would one day aim his weapons of repression more widely. 1 year after his re-election, he is doing just that. Journalists who report on his tyranny are being arrested, along with union leaders who question government spending and farmers protesting against land seizures. On May 18th, his goons seized Ruth Lopez, a prominent human rights lawyer. On May 20th, his tame legislature passed a law that mimics the repression of Vladimir Putin. Any organization that receives foreign funds or merely, quote, responds to the interests of foreigners must register as a foreign agent. It can then be strictly monitored and shut down on a whim. That will be crippling for human rights groups, anti-corruption NGOs, and so on. Mr. Bukele has also empowered himself to rewrite the Constitution more easily. Now that the opposition has been neutered and most watchdogs are muzzled, there is little to stop the 43-year-old from remaining, quote, the world's coolest dictator, as he styles himself, well into old age. Mr. Bukele has been a beneficiary of President Donald Trump's values-free foreign policy. Whereas President Joe Biden objected to Mr. Bukele's power grabs and slapped sanctions on his allegedly corrupt or abusive associates, Mr. Trump gushes that he is doing, quote, a fantastic job. In turn, Mr. Bukele lets Mr. Trump use El Salvador's brutal prisons as a memory hole for deportees, beyond the reach of any law. At home, however, Mr. Bukele's popularity has started to slip. Many Salvadorans dislike playing jailer for Uncle Sam. Despite safer streets, the economy is lackluster. Poverty is rising. Many public services are dismal, and ordinary Salvadorans smell whiffs of grotesque corruption in high places. Recent revelations about Mr. Bukele's cozy relationship with the gangs have been damaging, too. El Faro, a news outlet, reports that gangs helped him win his first big election as mayor of the capital, San Salvador, and agreed to make the murder rate look lower by hiding bodies better. Mr. Trump has obligingly sent back to El Salvador some gang members who were detained in America under Mr. Biden and may have dirt on Mr. Bukele. But silencing them will not hush up the scandal. Polls in El Salvador are unreliable, given widespread fear of the government, but some show Mr. Bukele's approval rating far below its peak of nearly 90%. This may explain his recent crackdown on critics. A spiral of souring public opinion and greater repression looms. However, Mr. Bukele will probably weather it. He has a knack for social media, a powerful propaganda machine, and all the tools he needs to crush his opponents. As Nicaragua and Venezuela show, autocrats can cling to power long after they cease to be admired. Mr. Bukele's entrenchment as a despot holds a simple lesson, especially for other countries made miserable by gang violence, such as Ecuador and Peru. When a would-be strongman promises to keep you safe from criminals by suspending the rule of law, he may succeed for a while. But there will be no law left to keep you safe from him. That was Leader Article Number 3, A Dictator's Progress. First, he busted gangs. Now, Nayib Bukele busts critics. El Salvador's president has all the tools of repression he needs to stay in power indefinitely. And we'll continue on to Leader Article Number 4, Intensive Care, How Labor Should Save the NHS. Among all its ideas, the most important is to go all in for digital transformation. Reform UK, the party leading in Britain's polls, has an uninspiring slogan, quote, Britain is broken. The fact that even the populists' bumper sticker carries none of the hope of Make America Great Again says a lot about Britain's mood. Nothing illustrates the malaise more strikingly than the state of their beloved National Health Service, or NHS. Hospitals are crumbling, sometimes literally. Waiting lists in England are 7.4 million, twice as long as before the COVID-19 pandemic. Public satisfaction has collapsed from 70% in 2010 to 21% in 2024. Broken was also how Wes Streeting, Labour's health secretary, described the service on his first day in office last year. But in the crisis lies an opportunity, particularly for the digital revolution the NHS needs. If Labour grabs it, it could cement its reputation as the only party to be trusted with the nation's health. If it falters, voters will not forgive it. Labour has two big incentives. The first is political. To its voters, the NHS matters more than any other issue. Its strategists see saving the NHS as central to winning re-election. The ambitious Mr. Streeting knows that fixing the NHS will be seen as a test of whether he is prime minister material. The second incentive is practical. Without reform, things will only get worse as the population ages and demand for health care grows. Other better-funded healthcare systems are struggling, too. France has a shortage of doctors. Australian emergency departments are as dreadful as British ones. Some Canadian hospitals are as overcrowded as Latin American jails. To make the NHS sustainable, Labour must modernize the health service. Its blueprint is a 10-year plan, expected to be released in June. The plan involves three main shifts: moving care out of costly hospitals and into the community, focusing on prevention rather than just sickness, and dragging the NHS from paper and pagers into the digital age. All are sensible, and all have been promised before. Past would-be reformers got sidetracked by penny-pinching and short-term fixes. Labour has already shown it could be vulnerable to repeating such mistakes. But this time, there are also grounds for optimism. so long as labor sets some priorities. The key will be for Mr. Streeting to go all in on digital transformation. This holds great potential to align labor's short and longer-term ambitions. Some doctors already use artificial intelligence, or AI, to transcribe patient consultations. Studies suggest this can reduce time spent on clinical notes by 20%. Another AI app, which lets patients scan moles at home using their mobile phones, has cut skin cancer referrals in half, a potential game changer for dermatology. And in some GP surgeries, the use of online triage has slashed waiting times and removed the stress of the 8 a.m. appointment rush. But tech performs wonders only if staff and patients embrace it and working practices adapt. To maximize the benefits of AI, more should be done with the health service's trove of data. The NHS is unique in holding cradle-to-grave records on an entire population. This makes it a potential goldmine for research. Researchers at two London universities are training an AI model on anonymized data from 57 million people in England, the aim being to predict future health risks such as heart attacks and hospital stays for groups of patients. Harnessing such potential requires investment, new computers, digital patient records, and integrating the NHS's fragmented and incompatible systems. It also requires avoiding being bogged down by centralized solutions. The government's plans for a national single patient record resembles a previous attempt that flopped. Instead, the NHS should learn from banking, which overcame a lack of standardization to enable customers to see their bank and credit card accounts in one place. In parts of the country, shared records are already helping plan, manage, and provide services. In Lincolnshire, linking NHS and social care data helped cut emergency department admissions by 58% in 6 months by flagging those who needed social care. Reforming the NHS is a huge task across many fronts. One is motivating demoralized staff, some of whom are planning strikes. Efforts to modernize IT systems are routinely caught up in a culture of mistrust and malaise. A proper transformation needs cash that the Treasury is wary of spending. The Health Foundation, a think tank, estimates the digital shift for England alone will cost £15 billion, or about $20 billion, over 5 years, around 7% of the NHS's annual budget. Labour did the unthinkable before when it founded the NHS in 1948. It must not squander the opportunity to modernize its own creation. We just heard leader number 4, intensive care, how labour should save the NHS. Among all its ideas, the most important is to go all in for digital transformation. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you are listening to The Economist magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona, this program featuring articles from the May 31st to June 6th edition of the magazine. And we'll move on now to leader article number 5, The Lesser of Two Evils. India needs to turn the aircon on. If its awful air pollution is ever solved, the country will get even hotter. At the end of March, the India Meteorological Department predicted a warmer-than-usual April, the first month of India's hot season. The forecast was soon proved right. In the first week of April, temperatures in big cities were 3 degrees Celsius above normal. By the second, Delhi was suffering in an intense heat wave. Even nighttime minimums hit their highest in years. Heat-related illnesses soared. India, always hot, has been getting hotter. The past decade was the warmest on record. Yet it has not been warming as quickly as the rest of the planet. In the past 4 decades, temperatures over Earth's landmass have risen by 0.30 degrees Celsius per decade, and by 0.23 degrees Celsius at comparable latitudes. The figure for India is a mere 0.09 degrees Celsius. Two things are responsible for keeping India relatively cooler. One is the expansion of irrigated land, the area of which has doubled since 1980. Moisture in the air lowers temperatures, but comes at the cost of increasing humidity, sometimes to dangerous levels. In the baking Indo-Gangetic Plain, a combination of temperatures of just 37 degrees Celsius, a nice day for many, with 90% humidity, can be fatal. The second cooling agent is horrific air pollution. During the day, particulate matter intercepts the sun's rays, absorbing heat. It also makes clouds more reflective. The combined effects lead to a comparatively cooler surface. It follows that there is a tension. If India achieves cleaner air, an unintended effect would be higher daytime temperatures. Some call for natural, energy-neutral methods to deal with rising heat, such as painting buildings white, using less concrete, and covering roofs in reflective tiles or second roofs. These low-cost solutions help somewhat, but they are no match for a North Indian heat wave. More air conditioning is necessary. Those who can afford it are already fueling a boom. Annual sales doubled between 2020 and 2024. Often, these machines clean air as well as cool it. One problem is that too few people yet have aircon. Just 1 in 10 households owns a unit, whereas 2/3 do in China and 4/5 in Malaysia. Aircon also creates even more pollution. During a heat wave last year, it accounted for 1/5 of power demand, much of it met by dirty thermal energy plants which provide 3/4 of generation. Air conditioners throw heat into their immediate environment, making conditions worse for those without them. The hydrofluorocarbons they use as coolants are powerful greenhouse gases. What to do? The only rational path is for India to push for cleaner energy and more aircon simultaneously. The country is getting many things right. State and central pollution control boards are responsible for cleaning up the air. Renewables, including hydro, make up 224 gigawatts of installed generation capacity out of 472 gigawatts, and there are ambitious plans for them to provide half of total capacity of 1,000 gigawatts by 2030. There are new efficiency standards for air conditioners. Yet the country needs to move faster. Pollution in the northern plains routinely exceeds the maximum readings of air quality sensors. That means millions die from pollution-linked disease every year. And if the skies become clearer, temperatures will rise faster. Speeding up land acquisition for solar projects, investing in the grid, and reforming the market for purchasing and distributing power would accelerate private sector investment in renewables. And a faster rollout of air conditioning could be encouraged by lowering the tax on machines from 28%, the highest available rate. Apple's iPhones are charged just 18%. The government should lead by example, air conditioning offices where citizens meet public servants, not just those of politicians and elite bureaucrats. Across Asia, the Middle East, and the southern United States, air conditioning has helped make cities dynamic and more productive. There is a way for India to combine that goal with cleaner air. It should seize it. That was Leader Article Number 5, the final leader in this issue. The lesser of two evils. India needs to turn the aircon on. If its awful air pollution is ever solved, the country will get even hotter. And now we'll move to that special report on American finance for two, possibly three, selections, beginning with the new masters of the universe. Financial giants are transforming Wall Street. Thomas Bennett hails their innovation and dynamism, but warns against hubris. Finance is an industry molded by disaster. It took a civil war to bring America's banks under federal supervision, a banking panic to create the Federal Reserve, and a Great Depression for the government to insure deposits. Yet the reformist urge that burns hot in the moment of catastrophe has a tendency to fade. Lessons are forgotten. Innovations happen and regulations become regarded as a nuisance. New risks emerge, as do new titans, who defend their successor system vigorously and convincingly. The conclusion of one crisis begins the countdown to the next. regulators can choose whom to target, but have less control over the firms that succeed in their place. Wall Street has never failed as spectacularly as it did in 2008. Its executives fueled a dramatic increase in borrowing, which helped inflate a housing bubble. The complexity of its financial instruments had made the system's fragility invisible, even to insiders. After the subprime mortgage market faltered, liquidity vanished across the financial system. Lehman Brothers was one of hundreds of banks to fail. Had the state not bailed out the biggest lenders, things would have got much worse. Reform crystallized in measures such as the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, which subjected banks to a vast compliance bureaucracy. Lenders have been forced to hold more capital and to rein in their traders. Regulators can choose whom to target, but have less control over the firms that succeed in their place. In 2008, Charles Goodhart, an economist, described the, quote, boundary problem in finance. Setting and policing the boundary between regulated and unregulated institutions is hard, he argued, partly because risk takers inevitably respond to regulation by shifting their activities into areas that are watched less closely. That is exactly what happened. Since the crisis, and especially in the past few years, a handful of American asset managers have thrived, often in areas that were the province of banks. Their lending activities, often called private credit, have grown rapidly, in part because banks are hemmed in by regulators. Hedge funds dominate trading activities where banks once held sway. Loose monetary policy helped. So did voracious global demand for American assets. These firms are beneficiaries of American exceptionalism. Executives at these firms believe their success confirms the wisdom of the new financial order. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, which recklessly borrowed from uninsured depositors who then ran for an exit in 2023, confirmed their view of banks as poorly run and intrinsically vulnerable. But is a reckoning coming? How would loans made by private credit funds perform in a recession? How risky is the growth in borrowing by hedge funds? Versions of these questions are being asked in every major financial institution and central bank. Donald Trump's chaotic presidency is making these questions more urgent. On April 2nd, Mr. Trump, quote, liberated America's economy by announcing massive and arbitrary tariffs. Financial markets promptly went on a vertiginous ride, their volatility reaching levels surpassed only in 2008, at the height of the financial crisis, and in March 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic. Stocks had their fifth worst two-day decline since the Second World War. Companies' cost of capital soared. Confidence among consumers and executives has been badly shaken. The self-inflicted trade crisis at times looked like it might precipitate a full-on financial crisis. Yields on America's government debt surged while the value of the dollar plummeted, suggesting investors were fleeing American assets despite higher returns, a troubling dynamic typically reserved for emerging markets in turmoil, not the global financial hegemon. Calm, or its semblance, has returned. Some executives see a real-world, quote, stress test completed, or even defeated, given how quickly Mr. Trump bent to markets and paused the full implementation of his tariffs. Share prices in the big private markets asset managers are still down a quarter of their value since their post-election peak in November, but markets have stabilized. Some contend only the pride of the Wall Street bosses who supported Mr. Trump has been damaged. But to be sanguine is to be naive. Even if Mr. Trump manages to refrain from smashing up global trade, the contrast between America's fine-tuned financial system and the chaotic condition of its politics is too stark to ignore. Wall Street thrives on the rule of law and globalization, both things which Mr. Trump spurns. Many of the conditions of a financial meltdown are in place. The national debt sits at $36 trillion, close to a record relative to the size of the economy. Asset prices are inflated and could easily be deflated if foreign investors decide to sell. As this special report shows, financial innovation has transformed Wall Street. As in eras past, surging asset values have concealed cracks in the new financial order. Whatever dangers are lurking, Mr. Trump's presidency will make them more dangerous still. We're listening to selections from The Economist's special report on American finance. That one was The New Masters of the Universe. Financial giants are transforming Wall Street. Thomas Bennett hails their innovation and dynamism, but warns against hubris. The second selection is Future Shock: How the Next Financial Crisis Might Happen. The new titans of Wall Street present the world with new risks. The trends outlined in this report have transformed finance. Many of them will only intensify. Private equity firms will keep diversifying away from buyouts into lending and life insurance. Hedge funds will continue consolidating and reaping the benefits of scale. The brain drain from banks to hedge funds and other asset managers will carry on. So will the quest of some on Wall Street to rip off Main Street. The craze in cryptocurrencies and leveraged exchange-traded funds is already making the meme stock madness of 2021 look quaint by comparison. President Donald Trump, for his part, seems more keen to profit personally from the gamification of markets than to protect investors through regulation. The instinct of regulators will be to disadvantage the new titans of Wall Street by cutting red tape for their competitors in the banking industry. Michelle Bowman, the Fed governor responsible for financial regulation, said recently that rules had pushed, quote, foundational banking activities out of the banking system into less regulated corners of the financial system. She wants to change that. Daniel Tarullo, a former bank regulator at the Fed, likens the competition between asset managers and banks to pressures faced by banks in the late 1970s from the growth of capital markets, such as bond markets and money market funds. The answer then was to deregulate the banks so they could more effectively compete, he says. But deregulation would probably accelerate rather than halt the transformation. Eroding supervision and capital requirements for banks will merely allow them to lend even more to asset managers and hedge funds than they do now, supercharging the growth of the new, less regulated giants of finance. Rapid growth in financial markets often fosters and obfuscates weaknesses, which become visible only during periods of crisis. How might a crisis play out? Danger could emerge from inside these high-flying firms due to, say, sloppy lending by private credit outfits or big hedge fund trades going sideways. The holdings in both industries are large enough to worry about. The five top players in private credit manage $1.9 trillion of credit assets across funds and insurance balance sheets. Assets of the five biggest multi-manager hedge funds sit at $1.6 trillion, including huge leverage. Even where these firms do not rely on short-term funding, their failure would risk infecting the banking system, which does. Some have been so successful that they have become too big to fail, raising the possibility that they should be designated as systemic institutions like the largest banks, which would give regulators more oversight. GE Capital received this designation in 2013. It was revoked in 2016. Apollo, the firm which most closely resembles the industrial conglomerate's lending arm today, could be one candidate, given its uniquely important role in debt markets. A shock could also come from outside these firms. Fragile regional banks, falling commercial property prices, and highly valued technology stocks are all causes for some concern. More so is Mr. Trump, who in his second term has already proved to be an agent of chaos for financial markets. As the tariffs-induced turmoil showed in April, the state of American finance is vulnerable to the country's corroded politics. Any sustained bout of worry about the safety of America's government debt where a flood of borrowing flows through creaky pipes, could trigger a meltdown on Wall Street. Highly leveraged hedge funds have come to play a critical role in this market. Wall Street beguiles foreigners. Governments abroad look on American finance with a mixture of jealousy and concern. Jealousy because the country's capital markets are rich and dynamic. Britain curses the exodus of its firms to stock markets in New York. Europe pines for a day when its members are as financially integrated as American states. A hopeless wish. They worry because they are more exposed to American assets than ever before. The flip side of America's current account deficit is increasing foreign ownership of its assets, since the dollars America pays for things made elsewhere are invested in dollar-dominated assets. That means a blow-up on Wall Street would mean a blow-up for the world. They worry, too, because the state of American leadership is much degraded since the last financial crisis. The response then was marked by global coordination as the world's economy collapsed. This time will be different. When the next crisis does come, American financial institutions will undoubtedly be at the center of it. The world will be left to contend with the fallout. That was Future Shock, How the Next Financial Crisis Might Happen. The new titans of Wall Street present the world with new risks. And it looks as though we do have time for a third selection from the Special Report on American Finance. Trapped Capital. What it means to be illiquid. Investors are learning how hard it is to get money out of private equity and venture capital. On Wall Street, the investment bankers who arrange mergers and public offerings are the first casualties of economic uncertainty. Coaxing wary corporate bosses to raise and spend capital is, unsurprisingly, much less fruitful than encouraging bullish ones. Mergers have stalled. Initial public offerings, including those of Klarna, a, quote, buy-now-pay-later lender, and StubHub, a ticket resale website, have been postponed. Bankers say they are, quote, cautiously optimistic, which is what business school graduates mumble when they fear for their jobs. If volatile policymaking is bad news for bankers, it is worse for their biggest clients. Private equity and venture capital firms have struggled to sell their existing investments since 2022, when central banks raised interest rates. When stretched, the balance of payments of an investor in such funds should resemble what academics call a J-curve, but ordinary folk recognize as a Nike swoosh. Funds quickly call in or demand the capital investors have promised in order to make deals, the short cresting wave, before returning it gradually with profits, the long soaring tail. The second part is proving difficult. Since 2023, private equity funds have returned 3.3% of the value of investments each quarter, well below the long-term average of 5.6%. Things are bleaker in venture capital, which relies more on public markets for its exits. The first wave of private equity buyouts, highly leveraged, often hostile, targeting large public companies, peaked in 1989 when KKR bought RJR Nabisco, a conglomerate whose holdings included Winston Cigarettes, for $25 billion. That year, Michael Jensen, an economist, predicted the decline of the public company in Harvard Business Review. Empire-building corporate managers tend to enrich themselves at the expense of shareholders, he argued, rather than erecting unwieldy conglomerates. Private equity funds pulled them apart. America's industrial conglomerates have since disappeared. Its private equity industry has not. Instead, it has grown large and cumbersome, in some ways reflecting the firms it used to target. After the financial crisis, low interest rates enabled the sector to quadruple in size. Debt was cheap, valuations went up, and investors were short of places to put their capital. That money machine is broken. Even before the tariffs, private equity fundraising had slowed down, reducing the amount of capital searching for new deals. Last year, assets managed by private equity funds recorded a modest fall to $4.7 trillion. All manner of techniques have been used to create liquidity, many of them seen in a surge of deals in secondary markets, where positions in funds or companies change hands. The value of such deals grew 39% last year to $152 billion, according to Lazard, an investment bank. Tactics deployed include continuation funds, where funds sell assets to themselves, net asset value loans, where a fund borrows against its value to pay dividends or allow investors to cash out, and even collateralized fund obligations, where pools of illiquid positions in funds are smashed together in the hope of creating something more appealing. Only naive or delusional institutional investors see these developments as anything other than signs of distress. The biggest private equity firms, meanwhile, have speedily diversified into private lending, though they mostly lend to firms owned by private equity funds, and other activities. Investors seem to think they have not diversified quickly enough. Their valuations have fallen dramatically in recent months. The share price of Blackstone, the largest private market asset manager, has fallen by 30% since its high in November. Whereas private equity firms find solace for their troubles in financial engineering, venture capitalists seek salvation from their own liquidity crunch in the next big thing. Counterintuitively, their capital woes coincide with a deal-making boom. In America, the value of funding rounds in which startups raised large sums from VCs hit a record during the first quarter of the year, according to PitchBook, a data provider. Artificial intelligence startups absorbed most of the cash. A $40 billion funding round for OpenAI was the largest in history. Silicon Valley's new interest in the defense industry is also generating mega deals, and some mega-sized companies. Elon Musk's SpaceX, whose lucrative government contracts are expected to grow under the Trump administration, is worth $350 billion. None of this will comfort investors who might need a quick exit strategy. America's elite universities have long been a top customer for private equity. Their endowments have extended time horizons and vast riches. But Donald Trump's assault on academia, including threats to research grants and to the tax-exempt status of universities, is putting pressure on their finances. Huge investments in private markets have left them uniquely unsuited to face a liquidity crunch, as they suffered during the financial crisis. Almost 40% of the $190 billion of Ivy League universities' endowments is invested in private equity. At Yale, where David Swensen, who previously ran the university's endowment, led the charge into private markets, that figure is 45%. The university reportedly plans to sell $6 billion of investments in private equity funds. Last year, all endowments combined sold less than $9 billion, according to Evercore, another bank. It doesn't take an Ivy League education to know that that will be tough. That was the third of three selections from The Economist's special report on American finance. Trapped capital, what it means to be illiquid. Investors are learning how hard it is to get money out of private equity and venture capital. And we have just a little bit of time left. So let's visit some news briefs from the world this week. Elon Musk decided to leave his job in the administration heading the Department of Government Efficiency. Mr. Musk's announcement came soon after he criticized Mr. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed the House of Representatives with just a one-vote margin and is headed to the Senate. Mr. Musk said he was, quote, disappointed by the sweeping tax and spending bill because it would undermine his work. A White House official was quoted as saying that the process of off-boarding Mr. Musk had begun. NVIDIA reported another bumper set of quarterly earnings. the producer of high-end chips for artificial intelligence, saw its revenue soar by 69% year-on-year to $44.1 billion, and net profit jump by 26% to $18.8 billion. And that was despite booking a $4.5 billion charge in relation to Mr. Trump's curbs on sales to China. Jensen Huang, NVIDIA's chief executive, reiterated his criticism of those restrictions, arguing that shielding Chinese firms from American competition, quote, only strengthens them abroad. And finally, after successfully making its way to space, SpaceX's Starship fell back to Earth. The uncrewed rocket broke up while re-entering the atmosphere over the Indian Ocean after spinning out of control. It was Starship's third test flight since it was upgraded with a new design. Elon Musk, SpaceX's boss, spied a silver lining. Lots of good data to review, he posted on X. And with that, we have reached the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the May 31st to June 6th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/on-demand.